It's Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a virologist who studied Zika, HIV, and influenza gives us the 101 on where viruses come from and how they change and evolve, and the big questions that still exist about COVID-19. That's still ahead. First, we're talking board games, classic, new, strategy, challenging, teams, trivia, you name it, we're rediscovering these tried and true cardboard competitions. And with people spending more time at home because of the COVID-19 pandemic, board games are experiencing a bit of a resurgence. And it's not just those families sitting at the kitchen table playing Monopoly or Sorry or Clue. There are a lot of different games out there. And people are even finding ways to play with friends and relatives across the neighborhood or even across the country. Our guide here is Gordon Lugauer, who's president and CEO of Board Game Barrister. That's a chain of board game stores in the Milwaukee area. Gordon, welcome to Central Time.
Why, hello. Pleasure to be here.
Why are we turning to board games at this time? What's motivating us?
Well, I will say, you know, board games, even before the pandemic, you know, we have all these little screens that atomize us, that break us apart. But human beings are at their core a social species, and we want to interact with one another as people. So we've always striven to find ways to connect and have those shared experiences. And games are a great, super efficient way to have those shared experiences, those highs and lows of drawing the right card at the right time or, missing that roll of the dice. So you get those shared experiences, those highs and lows, a lot of them in a really compressed period of time. And so that's why games are really so important to us as everything is pulling us and distracting us apart. I think here in the pandemic, the onslaught of change that is hitting us and a fair amount of the doom and gloom, the playing games and having those shared experiences with people who you love in that nice compressed period of time and what can be a fantasy and safe world where it's safe to succeed and safe to fail, I think that matters a whole lot in this time.
What are you hearing about the kind of games that people are choosing to play? I mean, are we going back to Monopoly or are we checking out some of the games that might be new to us?
So what I'm seeing is that we are not going to new games per se. We are going to safe games. We're going to things that we know. Now, that might be a Monopoly and a Jenga. It also might be more of the modern classics. But I'm seeing people that are going back to things that they already know or feel safe with and not being super experimental yet. And, of course, the big story to all of this isn't games at all, but jigsaw puzzles.
Oh, goodness. You want to go to puzzles right now, right here? We should do that?
I'm just saying that if you want to talk about what people are gravitating towards, jigsaw puzzles are so in the realm of games, it is things that are again, they might be new games, but they're things that people have already had exposure to. And then the attention that is being given to jigsaw puzzles is just enormous and orders of magnitude more.
Yeah, I know. I'm not sure of the status now, but I know there were times that there wasn't a puzzle to be picked up or shipped to you at all for weeks. Why do you think people are going to puzzles then? Because it's not a competition thing. I mean, I guess you could make puzzles a competition, but in general, it's collaborative. You're all working for the same goal.
Correct. And we're seeing that in games as well, that a type of game that is being very popular are the cooperative games. I think it's the sense of accomplishment, right? For so many of us who we aren't going to work, we aren't going to school, we don't get to see the fruits of our efforts. And so puzzles give you that very concrete, very tactile sense of accomplishment. It also gives you something to focus on. And being able to put your focus into something where you are participating and you are creating that outcome is really super important. And it's very different than being passive and watching something on a screen that's entertaining. Also good and important. But I think that's where the interest in puzzles is really spiking from.
Yeah, I mean, we had a colleague share a picture with us earlier today where it's animals sitting around a poker table playing Hungry Hungry Hippos is the puzzle that she just completed. So there are gradient puzzles that are, or, you know, things that are really the same texture. And there are some easier ones that might give you an opportunity to laugh a little bit or maybe those classic paintings, things like that. So that's neat.
Uh-huh. Sure.
And I do know that here on Central Time, we talked about puzzles back on April 10th. So we'll make sure that there's a link on WPR.org/Central Time so that people can check out more about puzzles there. Gordon Lugauer leads a chain of board games in the Milwaukee area. And we're talking about board games and puzzles and card games and other things that you're doing to pass the time. And there's room for you in this conversation. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. You can tell us what you're playing or if you have a question about a specific game. We're definitely taking them at 800-642-1234. Sarah on our Facebook page writes, "We bought Pandemic." So a little bit of dark humor here. "We bought Pandemic, but have played a lot of Exploding Kittens and the new Cards Against Humanity Family Edition. We're always looking for those cooperative or silly games because we have three boys." So there's one example of the collaborative nature we talked about. But also Exploding Kittens, Cards Against Humanity, these are card games.
Sure, absolutely. You know, I tend to think about things as just being games. You know, the manner in which you are getting that experience, whether it is from cards or whether it is from dice or whether it is from, you know, tiles or a rigid board in front of you. You know, the medium in which that experience is encountered, that varies, right? And that'll based on a whole bunch of things from the game design and the production and the costing of it. But to me, they're just all games. And whether it is a game that you are playing with cards or it is a game that you are playing with wooden pieces, it's still all about the experience that you're having back and forth. But yeah, absolutely. If you look at the set of our, you know, kind of top selling games, they're all over the map, whether it is something that is played predominantly with cards or played with tiles or what have you.
Interesting. And those two games that we pointed out are there are words on cards, or some games have pictures on cards, not your traditional deck of cards, but certainly there are many games that people play with a traditional deck of cards.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Absolutely.
This one might be a little bit challenging for us. We'll see what you have to say back to Lisa. Lisa writes on the Ideas Network Facebook page, "When one lives alone, there are no board games you can play. What suggestions might you have for people who live by themselves?"
Oh, well, so that statement is just not correct. There are lots of board games you can play. There are, in fact, we just posted on our Facebook page about a new set of solo play rules for the Harry Potter Hogwarts battle card game. And that's a game that is normally played cooperatively, everybody against the game. And the publisher just made a new rule set so that you can play it alone. So there are games that are you against the game. In fact, your earlier caller mentioned Pandemic. Now, that's a cooperative game where all of the players are playing together against the game. You can modify that really easily to play that single player where you are playing multiple people's roles against the game. So there are plenty of opportunities, more than just playing solitaire with a normal, you know, a 52-card deck, of things that you can do to play games. We've had a number of people who have been interested in the escape or unlock games, and this is a game trend that started about 3 years ago. If you're familiar with the new escape room style of group experience, there's a whole bunch of games, largely card-driven, that are simulating that escape room experience. So they're all puzzle games. They're often timed, and you're trying to figure out what the mystery is. And those have been very popular for single players.
All right. And we have a caller who wants to join the conversation now. Don from DeForest is on the line. Hi, Don. Welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi. I had a question about this new game I've heard. We were thinking about buying it, but it's sort of expensive, and I just wanted to get your guest's opinion on it. It's called Wingspan.
Sure. So Wingspan is a fantastic game that if you can find it, you should grab a copy of it. I'm sure you'll enjoy it. It's probably about $60. It was a big hit last year, but it has had just almost no supply. It has been very, very hard. We haven't had it in stock since January. Very hard to keep around. And again, that's in part due to Chinese production issues. But it's a fantastic game, has had a lot of press, won a lot of awards, a lot of attention last year. A game about bird watching, of all things. And that's a game that'll have both cards and a board and some components and so on. A little bit of a plug for the future, but the designer of that game has a new game that'll be coming out later this year called Mariposa that's about butterflies that looks really awesome.
Oh, how fun. And we do have a show, a conversation later in this show, actually, about bird watching. So, Don, if you're interested in Wingspan, it sounds like it's got some great reviews. And also, you may want to tune in later as we talk about birds that we can see in Wisconsin, because that game focuses on discovering and attracting birds to wildlife preserves, taking some of these real ethical and ecological challenges that we have right now and making it a game. So there's a little bit of a social responsibility aspect to that there. So that's certainly interesting. We are talking about fun board games we can play with our family and friends during the Safer at Home order. And Gordon Lugauer is our guest. He's the owner of some stores in Milwaukee. And you can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. We want to hear from you. What games have you been playing while you're staying home? Have you been playing any? What about over video chat? Do you have a new twist on a favorite game that you have put together? Have you changed the rules? 800-642-1234 is the number to call, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You're part of this conversation. It continues right here on Central Time. Thanks for being with us here on Central Time. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina, and we are talking about the best games to play during this coronavirus pandemic with Gordon Lugauer. He's president and CEO of a chain of board game stores in the Milwaukee area, and we want to hear from you. Margaret writes, we play Settlers of Catan with our son in L.A. while we're here in Wisconsin. We set up the board and resources to match over video chat, and it works great. Maybe you are like Margaret. Tell us how you're making video games or board games work across the continent at 800-642-1234, taking your suggestions for your favorite games, and maybe you could even get some advice if you've got a question about one. 800-642-1234. Carlin from Genesee is on the line now and ready to talk with us. Hi, Carlin.
Hi. So as a teacher, I'm interested in games that will help the children practice. I'm elementary teaching, so math skills, reading skills, vocabulary, science. I know things like simple ones like Boggle or Yahtzee, that's all, you know, practicing math. But if there's any other suggestions out there, I'd love to share it with the class.
And Carlin, are you thinking of things that people might buy or things that they might be able to do with materials they've got at home? Maybe we can narrow this a bit.
Well, either any of them, just anything, you know, right, something that they might have at home or something they could get. I mean, I know, like Yahtzee, all you need is the game sheet and five dice. So,
yeah.
You know, it seems like it'd be pretty simple.
Sounds great.
But anyway, if there was any other suggestions of good games for practicing, school.
Sounds great. Thanks, Carlin. Gordon, any and all suggestions for games that also teach kids stuff?
Sure. So I'm going to answer that kind of broadly and a little wishy-washy.
We'll take it.
The act of playing games is, of course, really excellent. Being able to, as you say, to play Yahtzee, you're learning to do a lot of quick math. You're learning some probability. These are all really relevant things. There's a kind of a subdivision of games that I like to think of as curricular-based games, and these are kind of really hammering in on a particular particular thing. So I think about like Smath or Mobi that are really about making quick equations, right? So that is really, really focused on a particular thing, and there are games that do that. Most of the ones that historically are out there are kind of like a glorified flashcard or there's not a lot of game to them, but there are some, again, I just happen to pick on those two, that in particular Mobi, which is a great little gamified version of math Scrabble. It is really fun to play, and at the same time, you're doing a lot of math. But something else to think about is the environment where you're going to get the students to be working on the activity. So what I mean by that is, like for me personally, I started playing Dungeons & Dragons at a very young age. What this meant is that I was now interested, because I wanted to, you know, play a wizard who was out, you know, fighting dragons, in reading these books that had fairly advanced language. And in the act of playing the game involved doing a lot of math. So that meant that the curricular-based elements to it was actually all subsumed into the act of playing the game that I wanted to do just because it was fun. So really, I would focus on what is the activity, what is the space in which you are able to have those students interacting, and then how can you make that more engaging through game, and then bring in some element that will be helpful to their curricular development. And again, math and language, if you have them playing games that involve math and language, it doesn't matter that they're maybe not, you know, doing fractions or quadratic equations. It's still good. Now, I want to have then my caveat to that is that there is a line of games, particularly for science, might be a little old for elementary school, a company called Genius Games, and it's a chemical engineer who has these games, and these are scientifically accurate games. It's not often that you will see a game that has an award or a citation from the Journal of Cell Biology on it, but that's what these games are. They are not science-themed games. They are science-accurate games. So, like, one of my favorites from them is a game called Cytosis. It's a little bit of a heavy game, go figure, that involves cell biology. So if you wanted to play a game that is an excellent game that is also accurately representing how cell biology and cell metabolism works, they got you covered. And so they have this line of games, they've probably got six or eight of them now, that are science-accurate games. So there you get something that's both curricular and in science, which is hard to do in a game fashion, and happen to be excellent games. So I hope that helps. As always, when you come to the particular situation, you know, talk to us, and we'll kind of throw some ideas back and forth and find out something that will actually be effective in your classroom or whatever setting you're trying to work with.
Sure. Get some more of those variables isolated, and then we can decide what might really work for you. That makes a lot of sense. We are talking with Gordon Lugauer about board games right now, and your thoughts are welcome at 800-642-1234. Steve from Milwaukee has one for us. Hey, Steve.
Yeah, I just wanted to share a quick suggestion of a game that we've been playing a lot over the lockdown. It's called Jackbox TV, and we'll stream it on our computer, and everybody joins up through, you know, like Zoom or Facebook video, and you just log in with your cell phone, and it's you know, irreverent trivia game, and we've really enjoyed playing that with groups all around the country.
Yeah, so not just close people, but really far away, all getting together that way?
Yeah, exactly. You know, connect with the people that, you know, are far flung.
Very cool. Thanks, Steve. Thanks for the suggestion. So Jackbox, one of them. I know there are online games that we can all join together, like what Steve said. But Gordon, there's also the idea of not needing to be in the same room to play. I mean, I'm looking at Saturday having my kids play Pictionary with a bunch of other kids, or like eight kids, three different locations. What am I getting myself into here?
Well, so, you know, your caller brings this up, and you bring this up as well, that there's actually three or four different buckets of types of games that'll work well in a virtual setting. So you have online games like Jackbox that are designed to be played entirely digitally, and there are also some board game simulators that'll work that way. Then you have games that will play well over, you know, a teleconference sort of setting, and you know, Pictionary is probably pretty okay for that.
Okay.
Within that, I like to break that into two different categories, and that is a category where only one person needs to have the game materials, and a category where everyone on the conference needs to have the same game materials, and they are merely having them changing their game state at the same time. So imagine if you were playing chess with one another. I could have a fully set up chess board. You could have a fully set up chess board. When you move your knight to e6, I can move your knight to e6. And so we're each looking at the same board. Your caller who played Settlers of Catan, that can work that way. If everybody has a board, you know, you can see that representation. Pandemic is an example of the first one, where only one person really needs to have the copy of Pandemic. The other person needs to have the camera pointing at the board. Your Pictionary can work in that second fashion, where so long as the person doing the drawing has the camera pointed at what they're drawing, everybody should be able to guess. And then you just need to have some way that as the different people guess, they can see a card that's telling them what to draw. And that could work by either everybody has their own stack of cards, and when it's my turn, I draw my own card, and then I draw, and the camera's pointed at what I'm drawing. Or if only one participant has the deck of cards, just everybody don't cheat. If it's your turn, I say everybody turn your eye away from the camera. I pick up a card and hold it to my camera so that you can see what that is. When you say it's good to go, I put the card down. You've written down what it is that you're drawing. Then you point your camera at your sheet of paper and go ahead and draw. So with some subtle modifications, you can make those types of games work. The types of games that don't work are the games that involve hidden information. So like if you have a hand of cards that needs to be kept secret mm-hmm. and the other person needs to have that, that's really hard to do. Because if we're drawing from the same supply, right, the deck of cards, whatever it might be, there can only be one of that supply and it has to be secret and random. And so that doesn't work well over teleconference. So if that's what you're wanting to play, I would just go to Plan B.
Yeah. I like those suggestions, though. Don't cheat and communicate well. That's what I'm taking away from this for playing
Correct.
Games
yeah.
from
really,
afar.
Really important skills. Yeah, really important skills, right? Yeah, don't cheat and communicate well. Yeah.
In games and in life, it works out beautifully. Stacy writes on our Facebook page, my husband and I have been playing a lot of Mystic Veil. We've also kept up board game night with friends using Steam's tabletop simulator. And she says our favorite simulated game has been Wingspan. So you got another vote for Wingspan there from Stacy. What are games that you might recommend that might be new to us? And how do we kind of figure out if we're willing to make the leap to buy the game, to learn the rules, to go through all of that effort to see if it's a good time for us?
So I'll pick on, you know, just to kind of throw a plug towards one right at the top. A brand new game, and then something that we've been recommending a lot, is a game called Cross Clues. It is a clue-giving and guessing game. It's super easy to learn. If you've played something like Codenames, this is like a next generation of Codenames, really elegant. And something like that, we have even made a video on our website that will walk you through your first game. So it's something that you can watch this video as you are playing your first game. We'll tell you where to hit pause so that you can do your stuff and then move on. So we're trying to find, you know, some things that are new that'll play well, perhaps play well over video chat, so that you can both be assured that you're getting a new experience and that you're not getting bogged down by learning how to play.
Speak my language. I appreciate that, Gordon. Thank you so much. The time has gone so quickly. We really appreciate all of the suggestion you have.
No, you're welcome. My pleasure. Anytime.
Gordon Lugauer is the president and CEO of Board Game Barrister. It's a chain of board game stores in Milwaukee. And we're talking with him about games that we can play during the Safer at Home order. And one more suggestion. Our producer, Bill, and his wife started playing this game that came out in the 60s called Kismet. He says it's sort of like if Yahtzee and poker had a baby. I think we'll take his word for it, but maybe you can try it out. Let us know what you think on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Now, coming up after the news, we've got a Wisconsin virologist who has studied viruses like Zika and influenza, how they're transmitted and evolve and cause disease. We're talking about ongoing research about COVID-19. I'm Keely Boltina, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we're talking with a worker health and safety expert about President Trump's order for meatpacking plants to stay open. That conversation is still ahead. First, we can study charts and graphs and look for that curve we're supposed to be flattening and obsess over the daily testing numbers and read all of the COVID-19 headlines we want. But we also need to understand something a little further, the why behind the news. And we also wonder, what questions do you have about how viruses work? We're going to try to answer them right now. There's a line for you at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. And we're talking with Thomas Friedrich. He's a professor of virology at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. His lab works to understand how pandemic viruses emerge, spread, and cause disease. And he's studied HIV, AIDS, influenza, Zika, and now he's working on COVID-19. Tom, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be with you.
As a virologist, when a new virus like this emerges, where does your mind go first? What do you need to learn?
Well, there are a lot of questions. So we know that viruses need to sort of solve a number of evolutionary puzzles in order to jump from wherever they have been before, maybe infecting animals, into humans and then spread through the human population. And when we look for evidence of how viruses might do this, we see that animal viruses getting into humans in the first place is actually perhaps surprisingly not the rate-limiting step, if you will. It's not the hardest part. Humans get exposed to animal viruses all the time, but how they evolve to transmit from one person to another and deal with our immune systems and cause disease, these are all questions that we want to understand for any new virus so that we can figure out how to stop its spread, how to treat people who are infected with that virus, how to create vaccines, and ultimately, hopefully, better understand this entire process so that we can make it harder for the next virus to cause a pandemic.
I think it is fair to say that it can be hard to grasp the idea that this particular virus that causes COVID-19 did not exist for us shortly ago, and then suddenly it has just turned our lives upside down. I mean, where did these viruses come from, and how do we really understand that?
Also a great question. So a lot of the viruses that cause serious human disease ultimately come from animals, and they jump into humans through agricultural activities or, consumption of animals or, all sorts of other proximity to animals. Maybe in the case of bat viruses like COVID-19 is ultimately a bat virus through, collection of bat guano for fertilizer, as people do around the world. So there are many ways that we can come into contact with viruses from animals. And then sometimes not only do those viruses infect one person, but they may be able to grow well in that person and then get from one person to another. And when it's a totally new virus to the human population, like SARS coronavirus 2 is, the virus that causes COVID-19 disease, none of us has pre-existing immunity to it. So we are all susceptible. And that means that in the right circumstances, as happened to occur this time, we can all easily become infected by a virus that is transmitted through the air.
You were part of a team that developed animal models for Zika virus, helped us understand how Zika is transmitted, how it evolves, how it causes disease. Now you're working on COVID-19. Why exactly are animal models helpful in trying to combat a virus that is affecting our human bodies?
That's a really good question. And I think it's important to note that, we as researchers take the responsibility of using animals to understand disease processes really seriously. And we don't want to do it unless there's a really good reason to do so. Unfortunately, a lot of the questions that I was talking about how viruses, overcome evolutionary barriers, how they may foil our immune system, how a test vaccine or treatment might work in the body and work against the virus, are all things that are really essentially impossible to predict just from first principles, just from what we think might happen if we put a compound or a vaccine into a patient. And so, for example, right now there's over 80 candidate vaccines that have been listed by the World Health Organization as in development, in some stage of development for COVID-19. There is no way, even if we stipulate that all of those vaccines might be safe, there is no way to test all of them in humans, certainly not in the time frame that we need to get conclusive evidence to move forward and make vaccines for the global population. So we need some way of down selecting only those vaccines and treatments that are the most promising and most likely to be effective with the smallest number of side effects, and move those forward into large-scale human testing when we're confident that they can be safe. One particular question with vaccines, for example, is that some vaccines in the past have actually, in certain circumstances, made the disease that they were trying to prevent worse. So this is called disease enhancement. Vaccines that have tended to do this have been pulled off the market, and so we don't want to be in a situation where we have an expanding pandemic and we rush to implement the first apparently successful vaccine without making sure that it's not actually going to make the disease worse when we're trying to prevent it.
Thomas Friedrich studies viruses, how they emerge and spread and cause disease. And he's helping us understand how viruses like the one that causes COVID-19 infect us. You just talked about vaccines. What about the concept of antibodies? That word has been making headlines a lot lately in regard to figuring out if a person has antibodies and if that could be used to try to prevent COVID-19 in the future. Help us understand that aspect of this.
Sure. So there's a few different questions that the antibodies have sort of come up around. And one is in treatment. So when someone gets infected with SARS coronavirus 2, the COVID-19 virus, they develop an immune response. Antibodies are part of that. And the job of antibodies really is to latch on to invading microbes and hopefully prevent them from getting inside our cells. So COVID-19 virus, like any other virus, is barely even really alive. Like, it has to get inside our cells and force them to make more copies of virus. And then those viruses go off and try to infect new cells. So your antibodies are there to try to prevent this from happening. Now, it takes a while for your body to make antibodies once you've been exposed to a virus or other microbe. And so the job of vaccines is really to kind of train your immune system, provide it with sort of a version of that virus, and get you to make antibodies before you encounter the real virus itself. Once people have actually encountered it, they make these antibodies. We could take a sample of blood from a person that is rich with antibodies and then even potentially transfuse that into another person and help them clear their infection faster. This is so-called convalescent plasma that you may have heard about that's being tested. So you can use the antibodies of one person who's already had the disease to maybe treat another person.
Wow. Yeah, it seems like a real opportunity with all of the different fronts we're trying to tackle here when it comes to this new coronavirus. We've got Tom in Milwaukee who has a question for us. Welcome to Central Time, Tom.
Hi, thank you. I would like to know if in order to study viruses or to understand how to deal with them, to combat them in humans, is it necessary to understand the concept of evolution?
All right. Thanks, Tom. Thomas, what do you think about that? Because, you know, viruses do change, and that is one of the reasons that makes them kind of dangerous.
No, that's absolutely true. I mean, evolution is kind of the fundamental principle of all biology, and viruses evolve so rapidly that we can really see it in real time. That's one of the things that my lab studies. And so we see it, for example, in influenza virus. The whole reason why we need a flu shot every year is because influenza viruses evolve to kind of avoid detection by our immune systems. And so we're always kind of in this arms race with the influenza virus. We make an immune response against it. It avoids that immune response. We make an immune response to the new virus. It avoids that. And one of the questions that we're going to have for the future is, you know, will this COVID-19 virus stick with us in the human population? And if so, will it begin to evolve to avoid our own immune responses? This is something that scientists are keeping a close eye on. I should say there is so far no indication that is occurring. But if the virus stays with us for years into the future, it's something that we want to be prepared for.
All right. Certainly not the last conversation we'll have about this. Thank you so much, Tom, for sharing your expertise with us today.
Thanks. It was a pleasure.
Thomas Friedrich is a professor of virology at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. His lab works to understand how pandemic viruses emerge, spread, and cause disease. Coming up, President Trump ordered meatpacking plants to open. That's despite outbreaks of the new coronavirus. We find out what this means for Wisconsin plants, still to come on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina. Coming up, it's a great time to be birding in Wisconsin. We're going to get tips on what to look and listen for. First, though, an executive order President Trump signed Tuesday says meat and poultry processing plants must stay open. He invoked the Defense Production Act, though the order didn't specify prioritizing meatpackers' safety. And we're talking about what changes with that order. We want to hear from you. Do you work in a meatpacking plant? What's your experience like? Maybe you think it's the right call to shut down plants with hotspots, or maybe you think it's critical that these packing plants stay open. Weigh in at 800-642-1234. Just a week ago on Central Time, we talked with Deborah Berkowitz about spikes in confirmed COVID-19 cases in several plants around the Midwest, including here in Wisconsin. She is a worker health and safety director at the National Employment Law Project, also a former OSHA chief of staff. And we've asked her back to discuss this latest development. Deborah, thank you for being here again on the Ideas Network.
Hey, thank you for having me again.
What has changed in this last week in meat and poultry processing facilities? What do we really need to know now?
So I guess, you know, a lot more plants have closed, including some in Wisconsin, you know, the JBS plant. And I think what we are finding out is that these cases that spread in the plants so rapidly, that did not have to happen. It wasn't inevitable that somehow meat packing was conducive to the spread of COVID-19, you know, because you're dealing with meat or it's cold. It's really because the industry, and especially the biggest players who lead the industry, JBS, Millfield, Tyson's, you know, way back in March, in early March and mid-March, they just kept the plants going as usual and did not really implement the basic CDC guidance that we're all supposed to live with about 6 feet apart and wear masks, because even 6 feet apart may not be protective. And so what happened is it spread very easily through these plants. Workers got sick. You know, we have 17 workers dead. I think 4,000 workers, maybe 5,000, 6,000 by now, meatpacking and poultry workers who've been tested that have been infected. And, you know, worker safety and health in the meatpacking industry is really in crisis.
Yeah, and let's talk about that more. Yesterday in a White House meeting with Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards, President Trump was asked about the order that he signed, and here's part of that exchange. It starts with a reporter.
How do you protect the workers, though, in those plants? What are you doing to protect
Well, we're
them?
Doing that. We're going to have a report on that probably this afternoon. We're going to have good form of protection, and through quarantine, when we find somebody that's not, we're going to be very, they're going to be very careful. They are, as to who's going into the plant. And the quarantine is going to be very strong. And we're going to make people better when they have a problem. We're going to get them better. Hopefully, they're going to get better.
Deborah, is there anything in this order from the White House itself that gives teeth to enforcing safety standards at these facilities?
So there's nothing in the order that sets any standards or requirements for industry to follow to protect workers. There are no enforceable standards coming out of the White House, coming out of OSHA, coming out of the Department of Labor. They merely have guidance that's voluntary. It's advice. Employers don't have to follow it. And if they don't want to follow it, there's no consequences except workers get sick. I want to make it clear that the Department of Labor and this administration that and this executive order, they have failed in their, they have a responsibility to make sure that workers are safe at work. Every employer has the responsibility to provide a safe workplace. And there's an agency called OSHA whose job is to assure that employers provide the safe workplace. But in this crisis, they issued no specific standards or requirements for industry to follow. So they don't have to put workers 6 feet apart. They don't have to give them masks. They can smush workers together in a break room until they all get sick. They don't have to do anything. And so what happened is they didn't. You know, this is an industry that's a, quite a dangerous industry. And, you know, over the decades has really cut corners on worker safety so that, you know, they have very high number of amputations, like JBS Pilgrim's Pride is one of the highest number of amputations, you know, of any industry and amputation rate. I mean, these are, it's a dangerous workplace. And why would you think that an industry that doesn't normally prioritize worker safety would do things voluntarily where that you could just trust them to do the right thing? I think industry just wanted to keep production going and keep their profits going. And what really has to happen is we need to keep workers 6 feet apart, not 2 feet apart. And CDC made it clear, and they can't work across from one another. Packing houses have workers working side by side along long metal tables and across from one another, all making like 10,000 or 11,000 cuts a day to process the pork or the beef or the chickens, that we buy in the supermarket. Everybody's slicing and cutting and dicing and pulling. But if you're going to move workers 6 feet apart, that means you're going to produce less and things are going to slow down. But then you won't have the plant shutting down.
Right,
and,
right.
You know,
to slow down the line.
Going.
Yeah, because
right.
the line moves too quickly for workers to be that far apart and to actually do what they're supposed to do because production moves so quickly.
But we're all making sacrifices, right? 50% of American households have lost some income or have lost all their income. So whole industries that are closed. Look at the retail industry. So this is an industry that needs to step up and do its part. It's, you know, they make huge profits, but do its part for the communities and the public health. It's just not right to blame everything on workers or blame everything on someone else when they could put in policies and practices in the workplace, keep employees apart, build break rooms outside so they're not all crowded in together, give employees masks, let them go to the bathroom many times during the day so they can wash their hands, and you wouldn't have this outbreak.
Deborah Berkowitz is the Worker Health and Safety Director at the National Employment Law Project. Also, she's a former OSHA Chief of Staff. And we are talking about meatpacking plants and the president's order that they should stay open while many plants have closed down because of outbreaks of COVID-19. And yesterday, in the daily DHS coronavirus briefing here in Wisconsin, we've got Governor Evers responding to the president's order. Let's give a little bit of a listen to one of the things he said.
The president's outreach on this issue, order on this issue, is important for making sure that our supply chain is good and make sure that we have good, nutritious meals. But at the other side of the story, we also have to make sure that our workers are healthy. And I don't think one can happen without the other. And so our goal is to be as cooperative as possible, but we do need to get those workers tested and their families tested. And because English isn't always the first language of the people that are in these situations, we need to make sure that things are done appropriately, culturally competently.
So Deborah Evers there is, you know, the governor of Wisconsin talking about this. We also see county health leaders in our state saying we can't allow these to reopen right now. They are closed down for a specific reason. So is the order from the president just opening things back up, or do we have layers of other governance that could keep these meatpacking plants shut down?
You know, I think this order was more about intimidating governors and local officials to not close these plants. I don't think there's really anything in the order that says claims to give powers to anybody to force plants to stay open. And I think, you know, the local officials, the state officials are doing it right. You have to protect your communities. You have to protect the people that live in your state, because you don't want a second wave. And it's important to get the plants so they can redesign things. I want to make one thing very clear. Some of the plants are putting workers back shoulder to shoulder with these plastic shield, plastic dividers between them. There is absolutely no evidence that those work in a meatpacking plant. I just want to make clear, workers have to be 6 feet apart. That is the gold standard. And yes, one day we will have testing for everybody, but we don't. And until we have testing for everybody to go to work every morning and see if you have it or you don't, we need to sort of change the way we do things to save communities and to save workers. And I also want to say that I think the president created a false choice. It's not a choice between feeding America and keeping workers safe. You can do both. And I also want to say one other thing. We're not running out of food in this country. Cargill, a big meat producer, said they disagreed with Tyson's and that ad that they took out. Further, just yesterday, the USDA just signed an order to send 1 million pounds of pork over to China.
All right. Yeah, Deborah, we're going to have to leave it there, but this is clearly an ongoing story, and we're certainly going to keep talking about it. Thank you so much for your conversation today.
Okay, it was wonderful to talk to you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Deborah Berkowitz is Worker Health and Safety Director at the National Employment Law Project, also a former OSHA Chief of Staff. And we talked to her today about President Trump's executive order that meatpacking and poultry plants should stay open. This is Central Time. Some people in Belgium are doing their part to help their country's potato industry by eating fries. Politico reports that Belgium is the biggest exporter of frozen fries, and the potato industry there says 750,000 tons of potatoes could be thrown away, that is, if we don't eat them. So industry leaders are encouraging people to eat the fries. They recommend picking up fries at local restaurants twice a week to reduce the surplus. That could help, but Belgium has about 11 million people, and it seems they alone won't be able to take in enough high-calorie carbs. They're looking to countries in Europe now to buy some fries and eat up. I feel like maybe there are less tasty foods that people could be called upon to eat, you know, in the interest of supporting the economies of their nations. I could handle a call to eat those crispy slivers of potato. Then again, I let my 3-year-old eat a hot dog for breakfast yesterday, so maybe I'm not the right person to offer advice here. I'm Keely Boltina. You're listening to Central Time, and this is the Ideas Network.